Shakespeare was actually a hip hop artist. Like, this is
Shakespeare
that
was
sort
on
of.
Vine. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the next stage. I'm Toby Vince, and I will be your host for this episode. Today, we are joined by Izzy from the Edinburgh University Shakespeare Society. They are going to be performing Shakespeare, which is, as the name implies, it's Shakespeare meets drag and cabaret. It sounds incredible. It is incredible. We got the chance to sit down and have a chat with her. Take a listen. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the next stage. So today I am joined by Izzy from the Edinburgh University Shakespeare Society, who are putting on at the Edinburgh Fringe Shakespeare. Hello, Izzy.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very good this morning. How are you?
Yeah, fab, fab, fab.
Good, 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 good. Let's just dive straight into this. This is a question that we've been asking all of our companies who's been on the season. We would like to know, what does fringe theatre mean to you?
Fringe theatre for me, I don't really want to give a full sort of emotional backstory, but I remember the first time I went to Fringe, I think I was 15, 16, and it was the first time I'd been to Edinburgh, and I think it just totally blew my mind that all day I could just see like as many plays and as many stand-up shows and music shows as I want, like could physically be there for. And so from midday till midnight, I would just be in and out of shows, and I think I was just like a kid in a candy shop. I was just loving it, so excited. And that's 100% the reason I think I ended up coming here to go to university, but also now sort of to live here, just because it was such a fantastic experience, and it made me, as well as falling in love with Fringe and that time, also fall in love with the city. It's just a really friendly, kind place, I've noticed. And so for that, to me, that's what Fringe means. But also I think it's re a really, really important festival for the whole arts and culture scene in the UK, and the world, to be honest. It's, the biggest culture festival in the world, and I think this is going to be my third Fringe performing, and every single
Oh,
time
wow.
it sort of sharpens what I get up to, what I'm doing, my acts, and also I think it must be doing that for other people as well. I see most of my friends that are either actors or comedians tend to say that the time of their life that they always learn the most is Fringe, because I think it's quite brutal in terms of schedule. But that sort of, I guess, like that pressure just drives you forward. And yes, you can technically burn out. But for a lot of people, I think it's just this perfect pressure cooker, to sort of perfect what you're doing. Yeah, so that's what I'd say Fringe means to me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that one. I think Fringe as a so not just necessarily Edinburgh Fringe, but as just Fringe, it's testament to the phrase like under pressure comes a diamond, because there's so much like incredible work that you will find that is either at the Fringe or originated at the Fringe. Like if you know your UK comedians, so many of them like Edinburgh Fringe especially, that's where they got their starts. And so some of the big names that are essentially dominating UK comedy right now, they were at the Edinburgh Fringe. So it's one of those environments that definitely, I think, tests you, but with good reason. Because I think if you are able to do fringe theatre and able to do it well, then that means you're able to take those skills of essentially having to do a lot of work in not a lot of time or space, and be able to, you know, take them forward for throughout the rest of your theatrical career, really, you know?
Absolutely. 100% agree. And it's funny, if I, you know, there obviously most comedians are up to podcasts because podcasts have had an amazing boom, which we love. But yes, a lot of them say you have to go to Fringe. You have to be there. As if you want to be a successful comedian, especially in the UK, you have to be there every year, partly because it's how people discover who you are. Because I just think, like, the sheer amount of shows that I go to see, just because I have a bit of spare time, so I'll catch another show if I'm up there. You discover so many new people, and that's really the atmosphere of the Fringe. And it's a lot more, I think it's just a lot more democratized than the current sort of performance industry that we have at the moment, because yeah, people aren't necessarily going to shows because, you know, that they haven't been put on TV by their friends, you know, dads, whatever, you know, there isn't that same level of nepotism and connections, which is just how, you know, sort of getting into performing tends to work. But at Fringe, it really is word of mouth, and everyone says that every year. They're like, oh, word of mouth is so important at Fringe, so please, you know, if you like my show, tell people about it. But it's absolutely true. Most of the shows that I go to or book, my friends will just go, oh my God, you know what, you have to see. And sometimes I'll think, there's no way I want to see, like, you know, an hour's worth of poetry performed by one person about something I don't know about or don't care about. And then I'll go and I'll think, oh my God, that was the best show I've ever seen. And so yeah, you're constantly being introduced to sort of new performance styles, new performers. And I think it's just a lot more sort of, the playing field is a lot more even at Fringe, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I think you've alluded to a greater factor within the whole artistic industry about the connections and nepotism and who you know. And also, realistically, how much money do you have goes into what gets put on. That's definitely something that, yes, although is present at the Fringe, it's not nearly as, like, big as, you know, down in, like, London's West End or the big playing houses, like, across the country, you know? It's definitely a place where if you want to see something that you're probably not going to have seen anywhere else, then you go to the Fringe, especially Edinburgh, you know?
And it's expensive. I think I'm very lucky to live here year round, because it means that Fringe is less expensive for me to, like, get to, pay for rent. You know, I have a full-time job during the Fringe, so I'm not sort of, like, risking that level. So all of those things are really lucky. And then I think getting to Fringe can be extremely expensive for performers. Most people can't take a whole month off work to travel somewhere else and, you know, just do a bit of performing every day. All of that stuff, I think, is generally the main barrier to people performing at Fringe. And definitely there's, you know, sort of disparities in how much marketing you get and, you know, what venue you get. And if you get picked up by sort of a group that will help fund your marketing, or, like, you know, PBH's Free Fringe, sometimes help with, yeah, sort of marketing costs, and having their sort of sticker on posters often, you know, encourages people to go. So there's those kinds of things that can create disparity and can be barriers to people, absolutely. But I do think it's just, once you're there, it's a very different ball game, where, yeah, it's definitely who you know and how much money you have and kind of what school you went to, when you're looking at sort of, yeah, the West End or, you know, any sort of, like, BBC drama, or boys hiring the same sort of types. Anyway, But with Fringe, it genuinely boils down to, has someone seen your show and did they love it? I've been to so many shows where I was literally one of like 3-4 people in the audience, and then the next day I'll say to my friends, everyone has to go to this show, da da da, and then they said, oh no, we couldn't get in because it was, you know, booked, or there were too many people trying to get in at the door. And it had literally gone from me the day before 4 people in the audience, and clearly every single person there said to their friends, oh my god, you had to go, you have to go, and then no one could get in. That sort of thing is what Fringe is, sort of where Fringe really shines, I think.
Let's delve a little bit more then into Shakespeare, shall we? So give us a bit of insight as to what the show is about and what inspired you to pursue the idea behind it.
So a bit about what sort of Shakespeare is about. So I've mashed together either quotes or plot lines from 5 of Shakespeare's big plays. I'm going to try and remember all of them now. But I always forget when people say, oh, so which 5 is it? I go, oh, don't ask that.
I mean, in all fairness, he does have a lot, so.
He has so many, and I'm hoping to write more sort of supercuts. But, okay, it's mostly, I think, Macbeth and Romeo and Juliet are the 2 big ones. But in terms of quotes, I've definitely lifted a lot from The Tempest, I believe. That takes us to 3. There are some quotes from Midsummer Night's Dream, but I'm hoping to do one that's a little bit more of that one, because it's very recognisable. People love it. It's fun. It's very silly. Yeah. And also, I believe, actually some of King Lear, the sort of flies to the wanton gods away quote about, you know, like little boys picking off wings of flies, basically. Yeah. So the reason that sort of inspired me to do it was I was just a marketing officer on this like uni committee team for Edinburgh University Shakespeare Company, and they were sort of thinking of ways to make the society sort of more fun, more accessible to everyone, just sort of encourage the idea that we weren't sort of scary theatre people, that genuinely, like, everyone wasn't trying to, you know, be the next Daniel Day-Lewis or, you know, Laurence Olivier. It was much more people just sort of like having a bit of a laugh together, and Shakespeare can be perceived as really serious and really because it is difficult to understand. And it is perceived as such. Because, yeah, the language is really, really tricky to get into. And I think what everyone sort of wanted was to get more people interested in Shakespeare, but also to get more people involved and feel like they could get involved. And so we were coming up with ideas for that. And I sort of came to Shakespeare because I was already performing in the drag scene in Edinburgh. So I already had this, that was most of my performance background, was through drag. And I'd done like 1 play or 2 plays at uni. And I wasn't really much of like a theatre person, but I just sort of ended up, in this spot. And, I said, well, how about we sort of do, a Shakespeare drag crossover. And I didn't really know what that would look like. And people were sort of very much all for the idea. But in the end, due to sort of like regulations through USA, which is our student association, our student union, I wanted to pay all of the performers who were going to be performing. And I wanted the majority of the money raised to go to Mermaids and LGBTQ plus Youth Scotland. And so there's just a lot of like weird bureaucracy and I understand that those things are there for safeguarding and all kinds of stuff, which is great. but it was, it just sort of didn't work out. So I ended up going outside the society and doing it myself because I thought it would just be a fun idea. And the idea for doing sort of a play lip sync instead of, you know, soliloquies or monologue thing and all of the script stuff actually came on the plane to me. I was that summer I'd sort of saved up and I was heading off to Vegas, which was a slightly bizarre choice, but I'd always just had a strange obsession with it. So that's what I was off to and doing, and I was thinking, like, I've actually got hours on this plane. I'm gonna write a script for this show that I've had an idea for. And everything just sort of started spiraling, I think. So I quite liked having everyone's names be something ridiculous. And I'd seen there's like an episode of Drag Race, which has a sort of like Shakespearean version, and that's why I was like, oh, I'll just call it Shakesqueer because then that's ideal. I also thought of Benders on the Board, but I was slightly worried that that wouldn't be received quite as well. So that was why I sort of chose that, and I liked how all of the names are sort of swapped out and that, and so I just sort of took that and adapted it so it'd be a bit more sort of, I guess, like British sense of humour. And so just got to writing. And yeah, that's sort of how it came about.
No, I absolutely love this as an idea. And it's something that you've touched on two topics, which are so like, I mean, to me personally, very important, you know. There's so much talk about Shakespeare's relation to like LGBTQ plus performance, isn't there? And, you know, before I get onto that, I do want to just remind you of something I just that you made me think of, which is that a lot of people get really put off by Shakespeare because they do it in school and they don't like it, and that's because, and this is, you know, my personal opinion, but Shakespeare's not meant to be read, it's meant to be seen. It's one of those things where if you can read it and understand it, then fine, but it's like reading a book in a different language. You might get an idea as to what he's on about, but it's all about the action and the fun that comes from it, you know? Like, Shakespeare's supposed to be fun. Like, you know, besides him killing off a few people in half of his plays, which isn't too fun for them, mind, but it's something that is fun for actors and it's fun for people to watch when it's done with that intention, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing that I found with... I was taken to a Shakespeare show by some like godparent or something, you know, a family friend, and I'd really struggled with it at school and I just was so confused and I didn't know how to approach it. And then I saw this show which was a version of A Midsummer Night's Dream that was just in the park, a classic, a British classic, you know. I feel like most people have you know, or, you know, heard of a production like that happening near them, because that sort of thing, it's, you can just literally hold one in the park. So if any kids are thinking that they might want to put on a Shakespeare show, great place to start. Summer, just do Midsummer Night's Dream in the park, don't have to pay for venue costs. That's ideal. But yeah, I think that just watching it performed is a different thing. And definitely in writing this, you realise how much, I think, well, I studied English literature at university. And I think when you sort of are really, really getting to grips with the text and you're looking at the text really closely, you realise just how many just like dick jokes there are. Like, most of the play is already like a raunchy drag show. It's mostly just like, you know, as I think my my lecturer used to say, knob gags. So like most pages will have like some kind of stupid, you know, like joke, and most things are about sort of like sex and cheating and betrayal, and like, and then there's a bit of murder as well. Like, that's usually how they sort of run. But anyway, all of that kind of stuff, I just sort of wanted to draw out and make a bit more obvious about the plays and show people that actually, like, this was intended to be entertaining. It wasn't intended to be a sort of sit down, let me ponder, you know, this grand idea. It's meant to be entertaining and fun. And hopefully Shakespeare will do that.
The relationship then between Shakespeare's work and like these LGBTQ plus themes, you know, there's a very wide debate about it. You know, you've got, obviously you've got people who debate about the queer coding of characters. A lot of people like have quite strong opinions of, you know, you've got Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream, you've got Ariel from The Tempest, you've got, at a push, some even might say Malvolio from Twelfth Night, you know? Like, there's so much debate over whether or not these characters were deliberately queer-coded. Would you say that Shakespeare actually, at the time, knew about this?
I see, this is a difficult question, and to be honest, even having studied English literature, I don't know if I have enough background in studying it to give a very definitive answer. But what I will say is definitely some of his sonnets, he was very clearly, he clearly had experience with or understood queer love. So sort of, you know, specifically homosexual, homoerotic. With, because there's so much, you know, fun he has with gender in his plays. He really messes about with literally just cross-dressing. Like, most of the comedies have cross-dressing, like, jokes. And I think that, if I'm being totally honest, I don't know if that was his intention. But I don't know if that's that important. I sort of think that we're still reading these plays. Everyone has to read them in school, pretty much. You know, we're still reading these plays. We're still, hopefully, watching them being performed. So they are still sort of existing now, and they're sort of alive in their own way now. So I think we have a little bit of input as the audience, or people putting it on, as to whether we perform these plays with intentionally queer-coded themes, and whether Puck is, you know, performed by sort of a drag artist or a non-binary performer. All of these kinds of things, I think we sort of have a choice in. And so I don't necessarily think... I think it's important sometimes to unpack whether Shakespeare sort of understood or intended sort of these queer-coded themes when people are using it as sort of evidence that queer people have always been about, always been creating art. I think that that's a really important thing to bring up and have this sort of like have, oh, well, look at like Shakespeare and look what he was putting on the stage, and everyone bloody loves Shakespeare. You know, that's a good thing to sort of, a good thing to have in the back pocket. But I think beyond sort of whether it was in his intention, what's our intention now for these works? What do we want to do with them? Because he's long dead. He's long dead. He has no choice anymore. And so I guess it's sort of up to us. And like, why make it boring? You know, like, let's make it reflect our opinions on the world and what we see. And to be honest, Shakespeare, I have the opinion of him, if he could have earned more money and more fame rowing a boat, like, he would have been rowing that damn boat. He wasn't, you know, he was a fantastic artist, but, you know, he wasn't, like, creating, you know, his plays were sort of like the Marvel movies of his time. They were just these mainstream things like of entertainment. They were, that's what they were for, that's what they were doing. It just so happens that he was just a very talented writer, and I think sort of had an amazing insight into human nature, and that's the reason that we still watch his plays and connect with them, is because they really do get to the core of what makes us human and how humans behave. And so that's why I think when we see these essentially like very convoluted cross-dressing plots and we go, maybe this is kind of queer, I think honestly that at the time they would have just found it really funny that a little boy is dressed as a woman who's now dressing as a little boy or a man. People would have like loved that because they thought chuckle chuckle. But you know, what we do with it now is, I think, sort of the more fun, more important thing, and the reason that we think, oh, maybe this had queer intention, is because everything is just so human centric in his plays. Everything is just about people and what they're like and how they behave, and I think that's great.
There's so much to say about his relevance to today, isn't there? And I think you've hit the nail on the head about, now, you know, he's been dead. He's dead and buried for 400 odd years, right? How does he still remain relevant today? And I think that you're quite right in saying that us as an audience, not just as performers or writers or theatre makers, but us as an audience, have responsibility to still make his work relevant, because we are able to see stuff through lenses that he probably didn't at the time, or at least perhaps didn't have as much of a developed understanding or modern understanding, shall we say, of.
What I'll also say, sort of in terms of, you know, he's been dead 400 years, I think one of the reasons that he's still taught in schools, and I think one of the reasons that like Fringe exists, which I promise I'll connect these two ideas, is because performing and theatre is a very like British phenomenon in the way that it's sort of, in terms of its history, it's been a big deal to us. I think that if we look across Europe, for example, historically, all, you know, the best painters and sculptors, that we'll give that to Italy, you know, and you know, like, yeah, in terms of like food, who's famous for food? The French. And and then, you know, if we go you know, sort of more across the world, historically, what's somewhere like South Africa and Zimbabwe known for? Really fantastic, you know, sculpture work. And, you know, we've got Benin bronzes sort of much further up north. And all of that sort of like culture and art, all of that culture and art, that's every sort of culture has their thing. Every culture has their thing that was one of the defining features of their culture. And I think for the UK, that's theatre and literature, in my opinion. Just because, you know, we've had some painters, I don't know, like, there weren't, you know, we didn't really have a Michelangelo, you know? You see a Constable next to, like, a Vermeer. Oh, yeah, that's what, we'll give that to the Dutch, yeah, as well, all of Rembrandt and stuff. You sort of go, oh, yeah, I'm glad we had a couple of these theatre guys, because we had such a rich theatre culture sort of in the early modern era. And even though we've got sort of like John Webster, who's a bit of a masochist and a bit crazy, you know, and we've also got, I can only think of his name as Kit Marlowe, Christopher Marlowe. Yes. I think I watched a TV show about him recently, so, but ignore me, Christopher Marlowe, and all of these people, that's what was going on for us 400 years ago, well, in terms of culture, that's I think that's our thing, and that's why things like The Fringe are so important, because I think it's like one of the very few, I think, respectable parts of British culture, and, you know, sort of actually quite positive, is theatre. So I think we've got to cling on for it for dear life, because we don't have that much else going for us.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, everything else we've either stolen or murdered or, you know, accrued through war-based crime. So,
yeah, at least at least Shakespeare was just some bloke from Stratford-upon-Avon. That sort of, we can just be like, no, I promise we didn't steal this guy.
He was actually ours, yeah. Listen, we have Izzy here, the writer of Shakespeare. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we're back. So, give us a bit of insight into the early development stages of Shakespeare. You know, were there any interesting ideas or were there any cornerstone moments when you were developing the show that have really stuck out for you?
I think in terms of developing the show, one of the cornerstone moments for me was... when I'd finally put up sort of like applications that open, and I got applications from performers who, you know, most of them I'd sort of known or, you know, done shows with, but some of them I just saw that they had applied and I was so excited. I was just so thrilled with the idea that they might want to be in my little show. And very much the sort of process. So we didn't really have a lot of rehearsing because it is a drag show. And so most of it is just lip syncs. And I really wanted each performer to do exactly what they wanted with it. And they would ask sort of a lot because it is so different from a standard drag show where you show up, you do your number, and then you have a little party. This was a little bit more like you've got lines, you know, there's plot. And so I think a lot of the cast people in it would come to me and be like, so wait, you know, what do I need to wear? Like, is this okay? Like, am I allowed to play it like this? And I was like, oh no, like, I booked you for a reason. I want you to do whatever you want with the character. It's totally yours to mess about with. And it was very much through talking to the performers and then being like, oh, I might play Lady McBitch like this, you know, like,
I love that name.
Yeah, it's got to be done.
I love it.
I have to say my favorite name in the play is still Calais instead of Paris. Because I remember writing that on the plane and being like, that is, it doesn't matter that no one else is going to get that joke, because that is going to just be like, every single time he comes on stage, I know I'm going to love it. I know I'm going to giggle. And then, yeah, through being called Calais, you know, the performer just decided, oh, yeah, I'm going to do the worst French accent and then suddenly break out of it. And it's really, like, just stupid humour. Very, I think that's why I wouldn't recommend it for, like, kids necessarily. That's the only thing that I will say about the show, is that it's very much 18 plus. But it is, I think, like, anyone can come to it and enjoy it. Like, it's not, it's in no way highfaluting, my God. But also, like, yeah, anyway. So part of the cornerstone process, one of the cornerstones of the process of writing it was just talking to the performers and asking them what they want to do with it, what they think they want to bring to it. And even it comes down to, because it's drag, looks. What looks were they going to give? And people would be like, oh, and then we sort of worked out that, oh, we would kind of be in groups, because we've got the two main families. You've got the Cappy Skets and the McBitches. And they decided that, you know, the Cappy Skets would be sort of like dominatrix, ho, lots of leather, big heels, sunglasses, smoking. All of that was the sort of like mood board. And then very much... for the McBitches, they would be like sort of well put together, slightly conservative, you know, or eat organic all the time, you know. And so we created, partly just through looks and what people normally give in their performances, because that's the other strength of Shakespeare, definitely, is that a lot of the performers come from very different performing backgrounds. So the majority are a drag cast of people that do drag professionally, that I sort of met throughout my time working. We've got someone who's in improv comedy. We've got someone who's got a very much more traditional theatre background, and that was their, you know, sort of like primary experience with Shakespeare. One of our performers is mostly sort of like a contortionist and circus person. One of our performers is mostly burlesque, and that sort of cabaret burlesque style of performing. And so we, falling into these categories, we worked out what people could offer the show. And, you know, sort of people would come up to me and be like, well, I can do this. You want me to do this at this point and in this number, and maybe, you know, we can write this bit in. And so meeting the performers was when it came to life. Because as I said, I just sort of wrote it on the plane and created the names and the plot. I mean, the plot was already done for me. A lot of the writing was already done for me. It was more of a sort of editing process in a lot of ways. And so after having done all of that sort of writing, when it really came to life and when I started in like liking it and finding it funny, was the first time I sort of started speaking to the performers and they started speaking to each other.
Yeah, and I think that's such a clever and beautiful way of developing the show, really. It's good that you have this script that's obviously going to be the through line for the show. However, saying to the performers who, as you've established, are already characters in their own right, you're like, don't worry about trying to fit whatever we're going for here. We want you. We want to see what is, you know, I don't know any of the names of like the drag performers you've booked, but I want to see your interpretation of Lady McBitch. I want to see your interpretation of Calais. You know, that's the beautiful part of this sort of work and style that you've written.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, hilariously, one of our cast members is called Himish Macbeth, and I did respect that. In that email, they literally just said, like, if I don't get booked for the show and my literal drag name is Himish Macbeth, I'm going to be gutted. that's the other thing, is that I've done marketing for a lot of theatre stuff. I've literally never had more fun with it than with drag, because every time I get to write, like, Butch Cassidy, too good, what a good name. And then I'll be like, Alicia Tried. What a, like, come on, Alicia, too good. Alicia Tried.
I love a pun name.
Yeah, and also, it would be so easy for all of, like, her kids, because they could all be like, you know, Alicia Came, Alicia Did, you know, you can come up with, anyway, yeah. Love all of those. But yeah, she's a fantastic, fantastic performer. And then, you know, we've also got, so I have all of that, and then I also just have, like, my my little, like, theatre and improv comedian too, who have, like, very simple Instagram handles, like, Hyg Lucas, who we've rebranded as Marquis Mucus, or, like, you know, it'll just be Christian Maddock. And they're fantastic, and they definitely bring an entirely different layer, and I think, you know, Hyg, or Marquis Mucus, who is playing Calais, did need a little bit of hand-holding through the lip-syncing stuff because they'd never done it, and was the only one of all of our performers who had never done it before. But I liked the sound of him because he had a great theatre background, and I was like, that's gonna bring something new. And so there was sort of a balance of, so he does pretty much all of his moments on stage with Lady Capuscat, who is Safiq, the burlesque dancer. She really held his hand through the sort of lip-syncing process. And when it came to speeches and acting, Hyg was fantastic in terms of support for most of the other performers, who, especially the ones who had never done sort of scripted stuff before. And so we sort of had, and in terms of like comic timing, Christian was always there, you know, giving people ideas and helping to, or, you know, Boffin Chomp is their drag name now. So we'll Boffin Chomp will stick with. Is just there sort of, and he, you know, he'd done work with my drag family, Fruit Salad. So that's, you know, my normal performance area. He performed with Fruit Salad before, so that's why I thought, oh yeah, you know what, like, he's got experience in the drag scene, he'll be great, everyone loves him. He's barely in drag. He puts like this, the grossest, most ratty plastic wig, like bob cut, and then we'll put like, take lipstick and to do two rosy cheeks and be like, drag. I just
but you know when it. Someone comes out like that, they can turn a performance.
Yeah, you, I mean, you'd have to,
you would, you have to. You know, and I mean, you know, drag has, it's become such a phenomenon across the past 5 years, hasn't it? You know, it's evolved so much as time has gone on. What would you describe the evolution of, in this case, Scottish and UK drag, and what is that kind of drag that we can expect to see in Shakespeare?
Yeah, so I think as I sort of said before, like, I think the UK has such a rich performance history, and I think that that's the same, it's the same case with drag. You know, in America, most of the history of drag comes from the ball scene, which is, you know, which was very, you know, sort of look focused, fashion focused, and to do with dance. And, you know, there's sort of like, there was a level of creating beauty in an otherwise really ugly world for, you know, sort of the community that was in the ball scene, mostly trans people of colour. And the history of drag in the UK has a slightly different one. And I think it's partly rooted in, you know, sort of stage performance. And the fact that, you know, cross-dressing was a big thing in a lot of British stage culture for hundreds of years. And then in more sort of modern context was mostly sort of like panto dames, and also like in sort of more Victorian times, kings were like, you know, sort of running essentially what we would might call like burlesque clubs, strip clubs. You would have drag kings being the MCs, and were very like sort of loved for being these comedians. And so that sort of the history of drag in the UK is very much more rooted in performance and comedy. And I think that you see that, and I think the two, in terms of what's going on with it now, there are two major factors I think that have influenced drag in the past 5 years in the UK, and one of them is going to be RuPaul's Drag Race coming to the UK, and the other is going to be COVID. And what I'll say about Drag Race is, I don't necessarily watch it anymore. I think it's done absolute wonders in terms of bringing drag to the mainstream. And I think that that is just fantastic. And it was, you know, such a one of a kind show that introduced people to just, you know, a totally different style of, or genre even, of like performance. And that's fantastic. But I think that what the UK scene really has to offer is its weirdness and its kookiness. I believe, like, Tia Coffey, you know, sort of made a comment on this, of, I'd much rather see, like, you know, a 40-year-old bloke and a lot of, like, bad blue eyeshadow telling a couple of jokes in the pub. Like, that's you know, you want it to be fun. You want it to be funny and silly. And I think that definitely there's a balance to be had. I love the death drops and the cunty numbers and the looks. I love it. But I think that the UK, like, what makes the scene fun and unique is that it it is very odd and weird, and you can sort of get into it literally by slapping on two lipstick red cheeks and putting on the grossest, most ugly wig you've ever seen. But as long as you're funny, you're going to be well loved. You're going to get booked again. And I think that after COVID, that being sort of the second big influence, I think people sort of reevaluated how they were living their lives. And I think a lot of people, because we were all indoors, just sat with ourselves all day, basically, or hopefully, I mean, I hope for most people they were with people that they were really comfortable with, but people we were really comfortable with and who made us safe and feel safe. And I think what people realized being in that space for so long was like, oh, I think a lot of the gender performance barriers got broken down a little bit. And I mean, in terms of my circles and my friends, the sheer amount of people who came out as non-binary and sort of, they were like, oh, it really took me like being indoors for ages and sort of having conversations with myself of, this actually isn't really me. And every single day that I go outside the house and I do my hair a certain way, or I do my makeup, or I wear this set of clothes, or, you know, I cut my hair like this, they're all so that other people look at me less, and I don't want to live my life like that anymore. And I think it brought so many people to drag in terms of both audience and performer as sort of a mode of expression and to sort of seek out places where they felt sort of safe and comfortable. And so I think that's partly why it's blown up as well, which, yeah, I think can only be a good thing. I just think it's such a warm, fun community, and definitely in Edinburgh, it's just, most people that you'll meet are just so refreshingly fun and just sort of there to have a good time. And so, yeah, Drag Race has very much influenced more looks-based drag, which, of course, love. So I'd say that's happening. But I also hope that people, you know, aren't necessarily writing off drag performers who maybe don't look a certain way. And that's, and that's another reason that I think maybe sort of drag queens, drag artists, weirdos, freaks, and drag kings as well, are sometimes overlooked. Definitely, you know, sort of non-binary drag artists. I think that we've seen Drag Race, and it's a very, you know, it's very much, you know, the performance of femininity. It's drag queens. That's what's, you know, being put on. And I'm glad that more of a wider variety of performers have been able to go onto the show. But there's so much more to drag. It's, you know, and there's so much, you can already see so much variety in drag queens. There's just as much variety in all of the other sort of walks of drag. And so I would encourage people to definitely seek those out if they would like to.
I think that with UK drag, personally, there's, it's very visceral, you know. You don't, when I think of UK drag, I think of the performance. I think of the rawness of it, you know. I think, so, like, historically speaking, I think one of the most influential people in UK drag would have been, you know, Lily Savage. For those who, well, for those of you who are listening who don't know who Lily Savage is, Google Lily Savage and have a great time, because, you know, when you think of Lily Savage, you're not thinking, oh, cover of Vogue. You're thinking, yeah. You are thinking, this is funny. And you know, Paul O'Grady, who, you know, who recently died, sadly, but he was the performer behind Lily Savage. He made absolutely no mistake of being like, this is someone who, like, is a drag performer. They are funny. and they're raw, and that's what people like. And they ended up being possibly one of the most successful people in UK show business at the time. You know, this was someone who ended up on primetime television and having their own show in like the 90s. And I suppose in a more modern context, you've got people like, you know, if we follow the Drag Race boy, you've got people like Danny Beard, who, when you look at the way that Danny Beard has, you know, done their makeup or does their performance, you know, as the name implies, they've got a beard. They have like a very white painted face. So it's not your traditional form of like female impersonation, is it? And that's what I love about the scene here in the UK. There's so much option to explore what is drag.
No, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And hopefully that's what people will be seeing in Shakespeare a bit. I think it's funny. I was sort of like looking at the cast and I thought, this is, you know, there's such a wide range of people and people are bringing such different perspectives. And, you know, it's majority drag kings. So we've got a lot of kings. Me, Himish Macbeth and Butch Cassidy. But even sort of, I guess one of our cast's more sort of traditional drag queens, Alicia Tried, you know, mostly performs in a moustache. And recently, they're so dumb, I love it. Recently did like a flying monkeys bit where most of the time they're like very put together, you know, gorgeous, just stunning, stunning queen. And then they did like one of the biggest shows we have in Edinburgh is Trax. They did Trax and was like one of the flying monkeys from The Wizard of Oz, just had like a little monkey hat on and the grossest like shirt and pair of like little spindly trousers. It was fantastic. It was unreal. So that's very much in Shakespeare. That's what we're sort of going for. I definitely wanted to book people that I just thought would be funny because first and foremost, I think we're, you know, putting on, you're not just lip syncs, we're putting on a show. And if we're going to be putting on a show and we're going to be doing Shakespeare, we got to make it funny. And so I've definitely gone for people that are a little bit weird. And hopefully we pull it off.
And I'm sure you will, honestly. If we consider the journey of this show, you know, from the concept of you on that flight to Vegas to where we are now, what do you want audiences to take away from Shakespeare once they leave the venue?
I definitely want them to take away a fun time. I really just want people to go in and have an hour that is safe and fun and funny and stupid, away just from like all everything that's going on. I think especially, I mean, originally that's why I sort of organized, I mean, it's why I sort of organized this as a fundraiser. I think that so many people's so many queer people's rights are under attack, especially trans people. And I think there's just so much anger directed towards queer people at the moment. And there's just so many, I think there's just so much happening for everyone at the moment, that I want people to be able to come into the show and just have an hour off, just an hour off of fun and good times. And then on top of that, hopefully that Shakespeare isn't that boring. That's such a cliche thing, you know, you're like trying to make like Shakespeare cool.
Down with the kids.
You know, Shakespeare was actually a hip hop artist, you know, like this is like that sort of brand.
Shakespeare was on Vine.
Yeah, literally. I don't want to like make it too cliche, but I hope that what people realize is that Shakespeare was always doing this. Like I didn't even have to write that many like jokes in that were ridiculous. Like he was already there with it. And it doesn't have to be this super intimidating thing that for some reason schools and universities make it. Like, it really genuinely is quite stupid. Like, his plays often are just dumb. But they also have the potential to sort of make us think more carefully about who we are and what we are. And so I think the balance of that is basically, I hope people come in. I hope they just genuinely have a good time and an hour off from, you know, thinking about everything that's happening. And then also, I hope people take away that drag is fierce and fun.
Yes.
And that everyone is just there to have a good time. And also that Shakespeare was always a bit of a weirdo as well.
Izzy, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us all about this incredible show. I do have to ask you, what is the next stage for Shakespeare? You know, what can we expect from you during and post the Edinburgh Fringe?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. For the Edinburgh Fringe, as most people, I think, or in the performer circles are sort of feeling, it's going to be busy. It's going to be very hectic. So I'll be performing with my drag family, Fruit Salad. I believe there are six shows every week that you can go and see. Some of them are at Paradise Palms, which is a gorgeous, gorgeous cocktail venue. Fantastic. Oh my gosh, fantastic Mai Tais. Can't recommend them enough.
You've got the more traditional style drag show, which is more of a sort of cabaret performance where you have comedians, everyone's in drag, but comedians, lip syncing, dancing, all of that sort of stuff. And then we've got jet drag, which we've sort of changed it to, which is basically a comedy drag show set on a plane, because we wrote it for this venue, which is sort of set up like a little plane. They've put seats, basically.
That's very cool. Theater. I like that.
And that's also underneath a bar. So if it's terrible, you can like drink a lot and not really remember anything. So I've got that going on each week. I'll be doing some tracks performances. If anyone does go to the Fringe, can't recommend going to a tracks enough. It happens every Monday, drag from 9, and then club night afterwards until the early hours of morning. So if you're coming from the back of a show, head over to tracks. It's a really fun old time. So yeah, that's what I'll be up to. If you want more information on that, you can follow tracks Mondays. I think I'm on the 21st of August. You can have a look at Fruit Salad Eddie, which I believe is fruit_salad_Eddie. Eddie is in Edinburgh, EDI. And hopefully, if you can't find those things, they should all be tagged in my Instagram, which is the incontinent, like incontinent as in you accidentally piss yourself quite a lot. The incontinent @_Riaki. So that's where to find everything that I'm up to.
Wonderful stuff. And where can we find information about Shakespeare online as well as the Edinburgh Company?
So Shakespeare is going to be, I'm forgetting the Instagram handle word for word.
That's all right.
Because I think tried 100 times to create an Instagram account. So it's called Shakespeare Fringe 2023. And there's no underscores or anything. It's just Shakespeare Fringe 2023. And we'll be posting updates and hopefully I'm going to be posting a lot of mugshots of the cast. So if you think they're really gorgeous and beautiful, you can rethink those ideas. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of entertaining content, I promise. So yeah, give that a follow and come along to the show.
Yeah, of course. Honestly, everybody make time to come and see this. If nothing else, make time to come along to see Shakespeare. Shakespeare Plays is from the 23rd to the 26th of August. It's at the Bedlam Theatre. Shows are beginning at 12:30, and that's for 1 hour. So I will just clarify this for you all very quickly. So if you were to book a ticket for the Wednesday show, this would mean that your ticket's valid for the performance in the early hours of Thursday morning. Okay?
Izzy? I'm so glad you clarified that, because my dad was so angry. He was like, why does it say Wednesday then if it's actually on Thursday? I was like, I don't I don't know. I don't have control over it.
It's bizarre, isn't it? And like, I mean, this is just, I think this is just a general preface for like the Edinburgh Fringe and any shows that you're thinking of going to seeing. Double check on the website, but off the top of my head, I think their idea of a day starts at 5 a.m. A day in the Edinburgh Fringe starts at 5 a.m, not midnight, contrary to the rules of time. For clarification, once more, say if you were to buy a ticket for the Wednesday show, it's the early hours of Thursday morning, and then Thursday show, early hours of Friday, etc., etc. Izzy, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us. It's been great to learn all about the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had such a fun time.
Thank you very much. And that was Izzy from Edinburgh University Shakespeare Society. Shakespeare, it plays from the 23rd to the 26th of August at the Bedlam Theatre. Shows begin at 12:30 and last for 1 hour. As you heard in the episode, like that quantifies for the early hours of the morning after. I won't explain it to you again, as you know how it works. Go and see this show. Like, I am telling you, this is going to be possibly one of the highlights of the Fringe, in my opinion. If you love theatre, if you love drag, if you love Shakespeare, go down to the Bedlam Theatre and see Shakespeare. It promises to be a great time. And as ever, support your artists, support your drag artists, support your LGBTQ plus performers. Go down and have a good time, because it promises to be a good one. This is our Edinburgh Fringe special. We have a whole host of different performers and companies and shows that we are talking to. Stay tuned for more episodes, and in the meantime, we'll see you at the next stage.